I'm Kevin Sheridan, and I met Mark Saunders about the beginning of the 80s. I was at that time, I was part of a video cooperative in the in East London in Hackney. And I met Mark because Channel 4 had started up and there was a flourishing of video workshops. And there were a number that came up in East London, and we would all meet together through Channel 4. And
What is a
the.
video cooperative and what is a video workshop? Because we hardly have anything like that anymore.
No. Well, I mean, basically, we were a group of geezers living in short life housing in Islington that decided that we were going to set up a multimedia workshop in the old sense of multimedia, in the sense that, you know, we had printing and audio and video and stuff like that. And we'd applied for grants and managed to get some.
Well, that's it. You see, it was
We
a
had
different
that.
world. It sounds like a different
Yeah,
world. And maybe you could just tell us a bit about the types of formats of what you were using. Because nowadays, everything, of course, is digital. Back in those days, it wasn't.
Well, no, I mean, basically, we'd bought a video camera amongst all the other equipment that we got through the grant, and it was VHS, and we put out, we'd formed a cooperative, so we believed in those things. The housing was cooperative, and the workplace was cooperative, and we had a VHS camera, so we letter-setted a load of leaflets and sent them out to various organisations that we knew about, saying we've got all this equipment, and people started coming along and saying, "Can you video this? And can you video that?" And then they turn up and they said, "Can you do it on low band U-matic?" Which was the next stage up. It was a sort of intermediate between VHS, which was very cheap, and professional. And we said, "Oh, sure," you know. And so we would hire a camera from the various places that were hiring them out, and work out how it worked the day before, and go and do it, and it worked. And then after a very short period, someone walked in and said, "Can you do broadcast? You know, five camera live shoot in the Lyceum." So again, we gave them a stupidly low price, and they said yes, and we went and did it, and it worked. And after that, we started moving away from the other bits of multimedia, if you like, and video became the thing that we were doing more and more and more. And so we eventually took out a loan and bought a low band U-matic editing suite and proper cameras. Channel 4 was encouraging sort of what were called workshops, so we sort of fitted into that, in that we were sort of, you know, we were trying to get grants to do open access stuff because we believed, like Mark at Tower Hamlets Arts Project, despite TV, that we wanted to give people a voice, you know, to hear unheard voices.
Yeah, so can you give us a context of how you first met Mark then?
Well, yes. So, I mean, through these workshops that Channel 4 would do, bringing together the various groups that were burgeoning then, it was early days of video in a way, you know. I know it had been going since the 60s, but, you know, at this time with Channel 4, they started flourishing all over the place. There was new equipment and you know, new networks. And so we met him along with Karen from Island Barn on the Isle of Dogs and the black video and audio collective. We were the East London groups, and so we met together and we all found that we were trying to do similar things. We were committed to giving people a voice, and rather than be competitive, I think we all found that we were cooperative.
Wow, well, it
So,
sounds lovely. But what was the sort of films you were making? Give us an idea of something that you had recorded.
they were sort of non-broadcast videos. So the more commercial ones where we could earn some money would be like local authorities, trade unions or NGOs, the sort of soft left, if you like, that had money. And then we did grants. We got grants to produce all sorts of films. So, for instance, there was a group of people that had mental health problems and gone to the authorities and said, "Could you look after my children whilst I got better?" And when they went back to get their children again, the local authority wouldn't give them it. So we gave them a voice. And then there we did stuff for the ANC, or we did stuff for local community groups. They would be, groups of interest in a way. So they might be various ethnic groups, eco groups, women's groups, those types of groups, basically. And we would help them make, that was our approach, was we'd help them make the stuff. So we would give them sessions where we would explain what they had to do. So when they came in to edit with us, they didn't waste time,
So in a
basically.
way, what you're doing is you're basically you're facilitating it, but they're producing the program. What about Mark, though?
Well, Mark, as I understood it at that time, was with Tower Hamlets Arts Project, and he was producing them. And this is the first things that came to mind. Despite TV, which was, bringing together all sorts of news items that various people had produced, and he was producing some himself, and then editing them into regular tapes, which would then be distributed to people. So he was doing a similar sort of thing in that he was allowing people or enabling people to have a voice, and then distributing and disseminating those voices. And he was doing a lot of training as well. But Mark was a very skilled camera person and editor, in particular editor. He loved the editing and stuff like that. And so, this was the type of stuff we were producing. It was like between us, loads of stuff. And people, I mean, I remember people would come from Merton to Hackney in order to get access, so it's that type of stuff.
Okay, so give us an idea of one of maybe the first of Mark's films that you saw.
Well, it would be the Despite TV stuff, and which were videotapes that were, we would get sent through to us, and that was it. But Karen, who was at Island Barn, she, at the end of the 80s, my particular video cooperative split up. We were called Anares, and Karen was at Island Barn, and she went off and did the first video diaries for the BBC. So that's where you give someone a camera and you give them instruction and they would film and almost a diary. And they were quite radical at the time. It was a new method. I know you see this reality TV everywhere now, but she was doing the first ones were like The Miner's Wife, or the guy who went back to Spain to visit the graves of his friends from the Spanish Civil War. They were very profound and they were very moving. Well, Mark had a different technique, which was to have group video diaries. So, for instance, he would, the poll tax riots, everyone knew something was going to happen. And so he trained a number of amateur filmmakers, provided them with cheap cameras, and placed them all over Trafalgar Square and the surrounding area. And I think there must have been something like 30 cameras. And so he was able to record that whole event and then edit it. I mean, it's a labor of love, that. Because you get 30 cameras with amateurs zooming in and zooming out, and piece the whole story together, which Channel 4 commissioned, and he made the poll tax movie, which went on to Channel 4.
Yeah,
You know,
so I mean,
so
there was also this whole thing of Despite TV, which is great.
yeah.
You actually get the TV to air a film, screen something, which is saying Despite TV on it, which is lovely, because obviously many of us, nowadays look at television as counterproductive, in particularly to do with things to do with social justice, but also spectacle productions. I mean, he was clearly hooking into this idea of the society of the spectacle, Guy Debord from the
Yeah.
Paris in the 19 in late 1960s. Can you just
Yes.
tell us a bit about that sort of ideology behind what he was doing? Because it wasn't just filmmaking, there was also some
No,
thought
no, no,
about agit
no.
prop and propaganda going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of part of the cult, counterculture, which I think we all were. We were trying to give, firstly, voices that weren't heard, to enable them to have a voice. Secondly, it was more than just, us going out, and this was for Mark and this was for Karen as well. It was more than just going out and, oh, we will make the film for you. We did do that, but it was also trying to include people, so it was a dual purpose to train them in the media techniques and understanding of what you were seeing and what you were doing. So it was participatory, and that was very important. The third thing that, as I've said already, Mark tried to do was to do group video diaries, if you like. So it was involving a lot of different people in it. And then, fourthly, I would say that he would involve anybody that was making a film with in a discussion about how that film would be created, how it should be edited, what its purpose was, what it was trying to do. So it's all about enabling people in a collective way to have their voices heard,
But I mean,
people.
that's a bit of a dangerous thing to do. You can end up with clash of egos if you've got too many directors, can't you?
Well, yeah, you could, but I mean, we tended to be anti-hierarchy, but understood that in certain situations you could have a temporary hierarchy. So it was a way of a group dynamic of being able to say this person, this for this film, is going to be the director or the editor or whatever, and work through them. So it was like setting up temporary hierarchies, if you like.
Well, what
But
about down the pub afterwards or down the coffee shop? Mark also, what was he like socially, personally? And did he bring all of his work? I mean, were some of the big films made, at least devised down the pub or what?
well, I wouldn't say down the pub, but we used to meet. We used to, once Spectacle was up and running, and my particular workshop had gone, I was still making films, and I would get productions come in, and I would work with Mark to produce them. Like, for instance, the mental health film about the black people's experiences in the mental health system, Hear Our Voices. So Mark worked with me on that, and we had a brief on that particular case. But Mark was always interested in method, and it was vocational for him,
Yeah, I mean, it's very easy, isn't it, to just make a film. It's very much more difficult to tell a story in a way that really draws the audience in, where you almost forget where you are and you get taken over by the story. So how do you do that, do you think?
Well, I think we would discuss, and so I still do, different techniques, different methods of getting a story across. I mean, basically, you were trying to, bring in the audience, and at the end of the day, influence them. That's what all media does in a way. But we were trying to tell stories, and so you would debate whether this was going to have maximum effect, I mean, a lot of people in those days, in the 80s, for instance, there were new technology came out, and it was full of little gimmicks and gadgets, for instance, slow motion effect or posterization, and you'd see all the videos from that, the pop videos from that period, and they'd be full of it. And we had discussed that you don't use a particular technique unless it's going to enhance the story. That content was king, and that the message about social justice, which is where we sat, was going to get through very clearly. So these were the types of debates we were constantly having about how you create stuff. I'm not sure how Mark came to be involved in video in the first place. So it's even before my time of knowing him. But I think for a lot of us, we didn't know. We hadn't been trained. We learnt it on the job, and we were committed. For us, the message was what was important, and the medium was just a way to get that message across. That wasn't always our own personal message, in but it was one of social justice, so that's what we were looking at within the debates and the parameters of that at the 80s.
Yeah, well,
And
look, things
as
have
the,
changed a lot now. You've got the sort of TikTok generation, very short, pithy little films, but many of them not edited much anyway. Although some of them, of course, have got this technique where you've got a kind of computer screen. They scroll through. They'll play little clips in. What do you make of the activism today and social justice coming out through the internet?
Well, it seems to me that it's an interesting thing. I mean, we were making 10-minute videos, which is an art form in itself, and now they're down to 30 seconds or less. But you've lost a lot of the nuance and the And the detail of a particular issue and all of those things, and really their short, sharp messages. But you're trying to do anything that's radical within that isn't, as it always has been, is lost in all the noise of all the other stuff that's going on. But you kept going. It was a love of
I mean,
filmmaking in and
there were
of
less
itself,
channels, weren't
but
there? Loads. There were less
yeah.
TV channels. Loads less. There's now thousands, millions of channels out there.
It's very fragmented, but
But I'll just
you
ask you
know.
about the social justice issue, really, because we've now got this cost of living crisis, we've got a housing crisis, we've got, it's almost as if all that was for nothing.
Well, yeah, yes, in a way, but I mean, I'm sort of proud of all the people I know from that period that a lot of them have kept at it and kept at it. And so the groups that came out, as well as the video groups, there were movements around vegetarianism. I think that when we used to try and be vegetarians in the 80s, we were having to eat egg and chips, and now you can get it in almost anywhere. There were all the identity issues, and now they a lot of them, they're not all solved, of course, but they're being platformed. The environmental movement, which we were, championing in those days, is now heavily on the agenda. It has to be, and these movements then are the undercurrents that move society forward. And so, on a surface, you feel like, the voices are being drowned out, but on the underground, if you like, they're the ones that are pushing against the status quo. And the sort of video workshops and the ways of participatory video were one aspect in all of those movements. And so I still proud of the people that I know that they're still at it. They haven't given up.
Well, okay, this is about Mark. So, have you got any particular moments with Mark you can share with us, memories?
You were talking about the pub, right? Did we talk about it? We went and did a film for the Transport General Workers Union, which was one that I was commissioned to do, and he came with me as a camera guy. And there were three of us went up, and we filmed all round Britain. Light rapid transit systems, and we're having a meal one night in Newcastle, and I've always been a teetotaler, not for a moral reason. I just never liked the taste, and so I got everyone an evening meal, and I said, "What do you want to drink?" And everybody asked for a soft drink, and I think it was the first time in my life that I'd sat round a table with people that did all drank soft drinks at the same time, so that was one for me. Mark and me, we kept in contact. We had long conversations on the phone. It was whenever he rang or I rang him, I knew that we'd be on the phone for a long time, because we were giggling, we were laughing, we were talking seriously about archiving, and about how we could keep the history of how all these workshops had come alive, about how we could, do multiple trainings and videos on very small budgets. So we were constantly doing that. For me, rather than a specific moment with Mark, it seems to have been over the whole period, was a feeling of great warmth and of commitment and of deep interest in what we were doing, and I found that Mark was one of those people that I could relate to, and therefore that's why I kept contact with him all these years, and where I could help him out when he was struggling, financially, if I could find something that could help him maintain a spectacle, basically. So I was only happy to do that. So hearing of his sad and sudden demise, I'm in total shock, and it's not been very long, but I've been thinking about him every day. I really am bereft that I'm not going to be having those conversations anymore, and not going to be, creating something new with him. And that's why I've got involved with trying to secure his archives and secure his legacy, basically, because the guy is an unsung hero, someone who needs to be known about. I mean, he was never one to say, "Oh, I must be at the forefront. I must be in the limelight." He did stuff because he believed in it. And I think that, that was similar to a lot of us in a way. It wasn't about saying, "Oh, I'm the greatest this and the greatest that." But he did do stuff like these collective video diaries, like his participatory video, and developing the techniques of that. They were really, really important. And you look at the body of his work, and he did Despite TV, he did stuff about the Exodus Collective up in Luton. He did stuff about various estates going through regeneration. They're really important pieces of work because he would go back time and time again, interview the same people going through the process. So he did like the Silwood estate and the estate in Rotherhithe. He did work with the people being shifted over the Olympic Games. He did work with the people affected by the Battersea Power Station development. Real urban histories and oral histories, and on an academic level, it's full of rich resource about what these people were really going through and how they felt about it, and it's thousands of hours of stuff. For me, he worked on light rapid transport. He worked on black people's experience of the mental health system. He worked on the Well London program, one of the biggest public health programs, the research programs. I was in charge of archiving the whole thing, as well as the community engagement. And he came out and he filmed in 20 different boroughs in the poorest areas. He's interviewed really important people like Murray Bookchin. He did The Truth Lies in Rostock. It's a fantastic film about fascists attacking foreign workers in East Germany. He did stuff about immigration. He was involved in all sorts of networks. As I said, I'm bereft that he's gone, because this guy was constantly, constantly doing it. He never made loads of money out of it, but he kept it going. It was like a labor of love.
Well, I think in a way it's almost beholden to us to keep it going in some way. It's hope that spectacle can carry on in some way. I mean, I'm so sure the idea of the Society of the Spectacle will continue. Also, the lovely thing, if I can just chip in about Mark, is having worked quite a bit in mainstream press in the big newsrooms in London, the The ego is overwhelming of many of the people now in there. They are just in it for themselves. They're in it for their egos. The cowards and control freaks are everywhere. And it's a very, very toxic environment. Almost imagine lot rather like politics or, top of a university or something. But for Mark, it was never about him. It was always about the person in front of the camera.
Absolutely right. I mean, this, as I said, it was a vocation for him. He believed in that democratic voice. He believed in, that everybody should have access to having their voice heard, and he enabled that as best he could with so many different groups and so many different people over the years. And it wasn't he wasn't one of the ones that was well known in that sense, although for me he was the one of the most important people that came out of all that 80s stuff, and he kept it going all through when the internet was knocking out people that were doing this. He still kept it going, and for me, it wasn't toxic to be with Mark. We love what we were doing. In filmmaking and stuff, you often get some of the most intelligent people, and on one hand, and on the other hand, you get people that are very good at the gift of the gab, and blagging their way through it. And Mark was one of the intelligent people, and he was, it wasn't about ego, absolutely right. And, in terms of spectacle, what we want to do first and foremost is secure the archive and make it as accessible as possible,
Well, that's the
because
lovely thing is, of course, that much of Mark's work is still available. It's still out there in one form or another. Anyway, any final words, Kevin?
look, I'm repeating myself, but just to say that I'm bereft that Mark's gone. He's one of the good guys, and who dedicated his life to through video production. That was his area, his love of the technique. But through that, he dedicates his life to helping other people, to giving them a voice, to developing innovative ideas. And, I'm just going to miss him so much. So, he's a guy that I'll always remember. And I just feel lucky and privileged to have known him, and through him meet lots of other people as well. And I want to keep saying, keep going, Mark, keep going, Mark. And I think it's up to us to secure that archive and make sure it's safe and it's accessible. And so, I am repeating myself. I'm so sorry for that.
Okay, Mark, Kevin Sheridan, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks, Tony, for asking me to say something about it. I hope I've done him
You
justice.
My name's Dave Barnard. I've known Mark since 1990. I got to know him after basically I bought a video camera and when I was out on a holiday and I took it down because I'd had background in sort of independent filmmaking when I was at Colchester Filmmakers Workshop. And I went down to the poll tax demonstration in Trafalgar Square in late afternoon. And, I sort of just saw that the police line was kind of like coming up the square and I started filming. And I guess basically got swept into the crowd. The police wouldn't let me kind of get them out. And I sort of like was sort of settled up to the top of the up by the National Gallery and was filming. I just saw the police like drive horses into a sit-down process, basically, which was really quite shocking. And and then went up sort of through up to Piccadilly Circus on that day. So it was quite an extraordinary day. And I, you know, got notice. I knew of Mark before then, but then I heard that he was, you know, getting together material for that demo, and yeah, I contacted him, and you know, that material was used in the back of the Bowder program, and I got to know Mark, you know, well, and sort of worked with him, particularly in relation to the sort of the technical infrastructure at Spectacle over, you know, the next 35 years, really. So that's kind of how I got to know him, and you know, sort of what, you know, we had a relationship over that period of time. And
yeah,
you know,
so can you, yeah, this is 1990, the riot.
Right.
You know, most people who were there at
yeah.
the demonstration, peaceful demonstration, can you just take us through what actually happened? Because Mark managed to piece that together, didn't he? This is what he called it, despite TV, despite the news coverage on the day. In fact, I remember him distinctly using some news footage in the documentary to show just how misreported that demonstration was.
Yes, well, despite TV, I mean, where he'd worked with others and been great in the way that they'd reported about the Wapping dispute and things like that, so I knew of that. And, yeah, so when I was there on the day, say I was quite, you know, sort of shocked about how, you know, the crowd were treating, obviously, that, you know, being in the middle of all of that. And, you know, the way that, you know, certainly, you know, rather than let people disperse peacefully, because I think most people, when they see a sort of potential conflict situation happening, you know, and there was a fire in the South Africa house, and there was obviously, I mean, I'd arrived after a lot of the violence in relation to police vans and things and being driven into crowds, and people I know were sort of, you know, fighting against that. And, you know, as I say, but I arrived after that. And, you know, rather than letting the crowds disperse and peacefully, they were sort of corralled and pressured up into a situation. So things kind of got, you know, more tense. You know, that was really quite, you know, I was surprised how, you know, that I wasn't, you know, as somebody who's been a late comer and I just arrived, I had a video camera, you know, I thought maybe they would treat me differently, but, you know, no, here we go. And, yeah.
Now, look, you work in the TV media video industry. What would you say set Mark apart? Because he wasn't like most film producers.
Yes, well, you know, Mark, coming up very much from the independent film and video, particularly when video became a thing that was possible to use, you know, in a cost-effective way in the mid-80s. And I was involved with Culture Filmmakers, as I mentioned. They were involved in documenting like the miners' strike, where the miners were actually coming into Essex to picket the ports where coal was being brought in from abroad. So we actually got, and I got to know about the sort of independent documentary movement, which was happening around the use of low-cost video technology, which had arrived from that. And Mark very much was somebody who, you know, took that and ran with it, and you know, his interest in, you know, social justice and community active action, you know, was something which powered his work. And you know, the technology which was, you know, become affordable allowed him to do that. And that was, I mean, you know, for example, Battle of Trafalgar was you know, quite unique in the way that it was put together and broadcast, and you know, was a very you know, high profile program. I believe there was I think it was called Right to Reply program, sort of, which mostly dealt with that program after it was broadcast. Yeah, it was very high profile.
Well, it's something quite ironic, isn't it? As a company called Despite TV actually getting their documentaries shown on mainstream, on Channel 4, it was at the time. I think it was, there were strands like Critical Eye, etc., which would show just about any finished film. Now the process is quite different to actually get something on the telly.
Yes, I think the independent you know, film and video movement back in the sort of mid-80s was a real kind of unique time, because I think, and it really was sort of propelled by the fact that this new technology was around, and with Channel 4 starting up, and Channel 4 put money into quite a lot of the workshops and organisations such as Despite TV across the country, and that, you know, brought forward a whole lot of new independent perspectives. I mean, very notable at the time during the miners' strikes, the miners' tapes, which were something which had been put together by local community groups about the strike, and sort of been, were won an Grierson documentary award. So that's and I believe Ken Loach sort of mentioned them very, very strongly. So it brought about a new movement, and obviously, you know, that's grown, and sort of in the way now that television broadcasting, you know, clearly now that everybody put something which is available to the world. Which is an extraordinary position, and it's just a clip away. So, you know, being able to get that channel of communication to people is something which really started at that time, because beforehand, broadcasting was very much a closed shop and a closed book. But getting it, you know, television programs and involved in that perspective was just really not something that could be done from an outside independent perspective, very, very little. There were some initiatives. I mean, the BBC had something during the mid-70s, which was very good. There was an exhibition recently in an art gallery about it. But there was very little kind of like community access to television. And that time really changed that. And, you know, we live in the world that's sort of created.
Well, we live in it now in a TikTok world. A lot of this stuff is very short. What Mark was doing was long form, much more considered documentary pieces, which would weave in lots of different interviews, wild track, all sorts of, you know, in the classic documentary sense, which we don't really see much of, you know, in the mainstream nowadays. But what was he like as a person? You know, because a lot of this, the best work, I think, in any creative industry happens actually down the pub, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, Mark was Mark had a great sense of humor. He was a great person to be with. It was a joy to be with. Great sense of great taste in music. I mean, it was a real privilege and a pleasure to be a friend of his and a colleague, a work colleague of his. And as I say, it was always good because, I would work with Mark just occasionally, and it would always be over at his studio, but it was always a pleasure to meet with him and see where he was in terms of his, you know, the organisation and technology in terms of the structure and like where that may be done, but of course the programmes that he was making, you know, and how he was utilising some of the archive that's grown up over the last 35 odd years. So
yeah, he was a bit of a go-to guy, in some ways I felt a bit of a guru in London. I wondered, what do you feel you learnt from Mark?
Well, I think very much, I mean, Mark was totally fearless in his approach to broadcasting and putting that message out there. I mean, he was very much willing to approach the media at the highest level. And obviously, he even did that very strongly with Black Trafalgar. And then later, and it was also some people who I became to know about with the Exodus movement of Jah people. With the documentaries around that, which was also an extraordinary time in relation to rave culture and how that connected particularly the community in Luton. And that's very much, I was actually watching some of that material with a friend of mine this afternoon, and it's amazing to see how strongly that came forward, particularly, you know, today, you know, because we're talking about, we're going back to, you know, 1995 and seeing how that scenario was then, how, you know, key their activity within the local community was to creating a positive environment, and how important it was for so many people, and keeping the peace literally within Luton, you know, times of rioting. So that was amazing to have been involved with that and go to.
Yeah, I can remember. I mean, I lived in Northern Ireland for a while. I remember people there saying that actually it was at the raves where the nationalist community and the unionist community would get together with, and this was almost like a solution to many of the troubles in the 90s. But look, with Mark particularly and yourself, there are of course a young generation, many of them, listening out, want to know tips. Have you got any thoughts for the young generation that are getting into this whole world of using video to try and change the world for the better?
Tell your story, connect with people and connect in a real way and get together in the real world and have a good time.
All right, Dave Barnard, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
My name is Richard Wolf. I live and have been living most of my life in Switzerland. And in 1991, as a geographer, as an urban geographer, we organized a conference in Switzerland about creating, founding a new network of activists and researchers in the urban field. And this is how I met Mark. I actually can't tell you in which way he came to join us, but we must have had common friends, colleagues, probably in London, because we from Switzerland and other students from Germany had already been in touch with people from the UCL, from the GLC, etc., in London. And that's really how we started this international network. And he came. And ever since then, since 1991, we've been in touch, meeting at least once every year for the annual Inora conferences, but also in between, because Mark was not only a founding member of this network, but he also became a very close friend of mine.
Okay, so can you tell us about this vision that brought you together? What is Inora?
Inora is the International Network for Urban Research and Action and was founded with the intention of bringing together activists and academics who are both or all both active, interested in improving living conditions in city, to put it very broadly, to improve social life, participation, housing, transport issues, and so on in our cities worldwide. We're mostly active in Europe, but we also have colleagues in North America, South America, Australia, and even a few in Asia and Africa.
Okay, so most of these sorts of organizations come under the auspices, by one reason or another, of Brussels and the European Union. Are you also affiliated with them?
No, we're not affiliated with anyone. We're a small, totally independent network, and we only rely on personal networks, personal friendships, personal contacts. And our ambition is not to become as big as possible, but as intense as possible, I would say.
So, can you tell us what your first impressions were of Mark and how you, because obviously he was part of forming this network.
Right, he was a very important part of this network because he embodied in a way what Inora really thought and would have liked and still is achieving to bring together this activism and academia, because he was like an academic, but he was also an activist. And he was the link between these two sides of Inora, having these very close contacts and relations with activist groups, because he was working with them, he was documenting them, he was educating, training them, and also he had this very intellectual side where he was keen on hearing theoretic news, theoretic information from the universities. And his ambition was to bring this together, and this is exactly what Inora was about or is about. And so Mark is like a role model really for what Inora stands for.
Well, look, activists and academics, they basically see each other most of the time as enemies. I mean, the academics are frightened of the activists because it could possibly end their career if they get too involved in the activism and, you know, threaten funding for their university, etc. And of course, the activists see the academics as a sort of part of the establishment. So how on earth can you bring these two opposite sides of the coin together?
Well, for this, you have to go a bit into the prehistory, really, of Enora, because we, as the sort of the starters in a small group in Zurich, we all were part of this so-called movement or youth movement of the years 1980 and 81, where lots of all the youth, everybody took to the streets demanding more space, more participation for alternative young new culture in the city of Zurich, which at that time was very, very traditional, very, very backward oriented. And we all took the streets, were big riots. And coming from these riots and from this environment where academics and activists had taken the street together, we wanted to get out of this, as we call it, the ivory tower of the university, and start linking up with activist groups to bring theoretic knowledge, academic knowledge to the street, but also to be part of this and to share the ambition of improving conditions of life in the cities, really. And so there was no rivalry, not openly at least. Of course, there's always some suspicion between the groups. But inside Enora, we had a very, very good understanding between us.
Sounds like both you and he were focused on the idea of the similarities between, you know, that people writing about what's going on and the people actually doing it. But anyway, so can you just give us an idea a bit about Marx's character and his expertise in these areas?
Well, I wrote this down for me in preparation of this interview. I think I've lost, or we've lost, three different Marks. One for me is a close friend who was important not only to talk about business or professional things, but also about personal things, very personal things. His family, my family, politics, of course, also. He was a very political man. We lost an important member of our network, a founding member, a pillar, a strong member of the network. And we've lost a very good, acclaimed filmmaker, documentalist, and activist. So these are the three dimensions I'm remembering Mark. And in all three ways, he was very important. He was very polite, I think. This is the first word I would like to say. He was always very friendly with people, open. And if I recall all the feedbacks we've got after his passing away, everybody said his smile. Everybody remembers his smile. It was a subtle smile, but it was a very sympathetic smile. He was always interested in what people were doing. Obviously, as a documentalist, he was always asking people, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? And he was also a very interesting person because he came from this very political approach to telling about and documenting about people, always with this angle of social justice, really. And this what made him so kind and so sympathetic to me. And he was very humorous, of course. I loved to spend time with him. He was always fun. It was always fun walking with him through the cities for hours and hours, and talking and commenting on what we saw and how we would argue about things was also very similar.
Well, look, he's quite well known, a little bit well known. I mean, he's not as well known as many of the filmmakers in Britain, but he's known for his documentary, which went out on Channel 4. I think it was 1991, maybe. Over the poll tax riots, the Battle of Trafalgar. He's really known for his London work, Also, of course, Luton, the Exodus films, the Battle of Wapping, Despite the Sun, in the 1980s, when Margaret Thatcher was really changing Britain and putting it on the course where we have ended up today. Thank you, Maggie. But what about his work in other cities? And I mean, was he actually active in Europe much at all, or was it just London?
Well, you've mentioned all the important films in London and in the UK. The ones I remember best is the poll tax riots, of course, and the Exodus. I was a little tiny bit involved in the Exodus thing. I met all the Exodus collective, and we organized a meeting in Zurich even. They had a rave in the cultural center in Zurich. So the London side apparently is well known. But there's one, especially one thing you have to mention, because it's important for German history, really. It's an important documentary for the history of post-1989 Germany. And this was a pogrom, I think we must call it, riots in the city of Rostock in former Eastern Germany. But the riots happened after the unification in 90 or count beginnings of the 1990s, and that film was called The Truth Lies in Rostock, because it was about all sorts of strange political administrative things happening behind the curtains, inside police, inside government in Eastern Germany, about failures to crack down the riots in Rostock, which were against foreign, how do you say, proper politically correct immigrant workers from Vietnam and other countries in Eastern Germany, living in a separate housing estate in the city of Rostock.
Right, so
And
they weren't integrated, but I mean, what you're suggesting here maybe is that the old Soviet system had kept a lid on this, and once the Berlin Wall was down, things started to erupt.
You could put it that way. It was right wing. It was fascist, I think you can say, riots against immigrant labor in former Eastern Germany. And he was the one that documented all this. And his footage is unique. And his his film, his movie is also unique and a very important element of understanding what happened after the turn in 1989. It was shown on German TV several times, and he still had invitations in Germany to go to Germany and show his documentary and talk about it. And he's still in touch with the people in Rostock. And that also came through Inora. By the way, that was one of the effects or impacts of Inura.
So what about Mark the person, Mark the man? You've said that you chatted about personal stuff as well, but can you just maybe think of a couple of incidents with Mark that really tell you what kind of character he was?
I think my best memories are of about walking with him through the city. The last one was Tampere in Finland 3 weeks ago, where we had our annual Inora conference. And we would just say, let's come on, we meet at 9 and we see what we do. And then we start walking, and we walk around the city. Sometimes we'd have specific places we want to see and visit. And it was great to go with him, because he was also someone who could really easily connect with people. The both of us, we're very open-minded. And so when we walked around anywhere, we always got in touch with people and started conversations and finding out new things and about people, about the city, and so on. So he was a very, how do you say, a curious? Yeah, I think he was very interested always, and so was I.
Yeah,
And we always
inquisitive, maybe.
inquisitive, exactly, like a good documentalist is. So it was very exciting to be with him all the time, and never boring. Usually a lot of fun. We'd laugh a lot. And I think that's for the friends I like. My friends I like best are the ones I can
I
laugh.
suppose in many, many cities, you can look around them and see absurdities. I mean, it's fascinating what you say about this idea of just chatting with people as you're wandering around. There's two reasons why this is very, very unlikely in documentary filmmakers. Number one, the city is not a place where people approach strangers and ask them how they are, what they're doing. And also, the media people tend to send, if they're going to make a film, they tend to already pretty much decided what they're going to do. They send out someone to tell them what they already think they know. So what you're doing is you're breaking down all these assumptions and boundaries in just a wander around a city.
Yeah, that's true. It's like the dérive, the strolling around city and just observing and diving into the reality you find yourself in without many preconceptions really. And so I think that's the most interesting way to get to know a city anyway.
Yeah, and also to make maybe to you know to, on filmmaking where you set off to make a film that you actually don't know quite how it's going to come across. But I know Mark was his company was Spectacle Productions. He had this moniker certainly in the early days in the 1980s of Despite TV, which is
yes.
almost sticking two fingers up to the establishment television networks. Despite TV. What about this whole idea of the Society of the Spectacle, Guy Debord and the Situationists? Because it seems like this is something that he kind of wove into his work in all his productions.
That's a long discussion, I think, and I'm not too much of a situationist either, but I think what he was very well at was at taking a situation as it is and not coming with a preconception how it should be, but just looking at it and making sense out of it, making sense out of what you see. Without having a strict a concept of what you actually want to do, so this openness, I think it's mostly the openness for perception for appreciation of the given.
A lot of youngsters are getting into making videos, TikTok and this sort of thing nowadays, quite different to the considered documentaries that Mark was making. You know, with interwoven. Threads of interrogation of a subject, and what advice? I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard him give advice to young people now. Do you think he would have for people thinking of getting into filmmaking today?
Well, one of the things we haven't talked about yet was his training people. I think that was very important for him. Not just to have people who would then work with him. Of course, that was also could have been also a goal, but training people to do their own videos, to become video documentalists. And he trained people from a wide array of backgrounds. He trained people from the Silwood Estate in London, but he also trained people from the UNESCO, for example, staff from United Nations. But his main, I think, interest was in training youth in underprivileged youth, helping to express themselves with the means of video technique. And I think there he did a great job. And I know he didn't only do this in London, but also in Brussels. I know he worked in Brussels with video activist groups in Rostock, I said already. And inside the Inura network, he had contacts with people in Austria, in Italy, and many, many other places. And he was a demanded person. He was in high demand for his expertise, his experience, and his longstanding practice that he could really draw all this information, this knowledge, this practical knowledge from.
Well, look, both you in the network and Mark were constantly observing privatization, the changing face of the cities, the privatization of public streets into these MALs, which are all private security, this sort of thing. Also, the rising problem of the cost of living here in the UK and other parts of the EU, lowering standards in employment rights and pay, this sort of thing. In a way, don't you think that yourself with your network and Mark, we're kind of putting the finger in the dike, actually, that the flood is all going in the wrong direction today?
Yeah, but of course we weren't the only ones criticizing this. There's lots of trade unions, leftist parties, all sorts of activist groups, all complaining and pointing at the same issues. And the interesting thing about the network and working together with people from other cities is, of course, to see how similar most of the core problems are worldwide. Of course, there's differences, but a lot of similarities. Housing issues in thriving cities, in inner cities, is a big issue. The ecological issue, of course, is a big one. It's global. And the whole thing about privatizing public space has been an issue ever since, I don't know how long, at least until the Thatcher-Reagan years, probably even before, but with an accelerating pace, probably. And pointing this out and connecting with people and experiences in other cities means also learning from how to counter, how to defend, how to react, or how to act. Even more importantly, how to act when you see these problems becoming bigger and getting more important in your cities.
Now, look, one I think important, I mean, I try and do this with my radio show, is you've always got to offer a bit of a candle of hope at the end. Do you think there is anything that people can actually do about the slow, it seems like, strangulation of society in cities? Certainly here in Britain, we're feeling the pinch with the withdrawal of all sorts of public services, basic facilities, even things like pubs closing at a terrible rate of knots, public space disappearing, Richard.
Yeah, I know. Of course, there's hope. If we wouldn't have any hope, I think we would have given up. And there's no po there's that doesn't make sense in life to give up. So there is. If you look around, and this is also what our network is about. We try to bring together activist groups to also show and prove that they're not the only ones, but that there's other activist groups in other places who are dealing with the same problems and perhaps have different solutions and solutions that one can learn from. So there's a lot of people out there organizing themselves. There's a lot of protests everywhere. There is a lot of empowerment going on everywhere, and we have to build on these elements and bring them together and put them together in a way where opposition makes sense and achieves results and can show successes of preventing the developments, of supporting positive developments, and so on. And I think this is what we're doing, and this is what we're trying. And we're just one little element in the world of opposition, really.
Well, look, media is the way that we all find out what's going on elsewhere. It's almost like the nervous system of humanity. What do you think Mark's legacy is or will be?
Well, one of his legacies is the films we've already talked about, the finished products, the big products, the big films shown on television and many other places. So that's one of the legacies. I think his big legacy we're now dealing with, now it means these days, is saving and continuing his archives. He has an unbelievably big archive with thousands of hours of documented actions and films and interviews with interesting people. And this material has to be saved, and it has to stay accessible. It has to that it can be worked with, further work, further documentaries. There's enough material for dozens of documentaries that still can and should be done with the material he's shot. So his films, his archives, and all the people he's been in touch with and all the people he has supported, he has empowered, he has trained with technical abilities, and also techniques of interviewing, techniques of organizing, techniques, methodologies of how to work with activist groups. I think that's the probably the biggest legacy.
Okay, Richard Wolf in Zurich, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tony.